So welcome everyone to our special Torah class. We're calling it Malchut, royalty, and we're dedicating it to the memory of Queen Elizabeth II. So I want to preface my comments first that I am Canadian born, very proud Canadian, and she's on our dollar bill, on all the coins of Canada. We're part of the Commonwealth. In fact, the Governor General of Canada is the Queen's emissary. And it's once again, it's sort of like the Queen. She's an honorary Queen. And the Governor General rules Canada in an honorary way. I mean, obviously, the Parliament itself is the legislative body, but we still have the Queen as our titular head. So it's a very near and dear thing to me. And I recall as a little boy being schlepped up five blocks to Granville Street in Vancouver to have a glimpse at Queen Elizabeth. And she came down in a Rolls Royce limousine down Granville Street. And we were all little pitsalach waiting there patiently for about 2 hours to wave to her and to cheer her. And I don't know if I ever actually saw her, like literally saw her, but I remember the gloved hand waving. So that was my earliest memory of the Queen. And then my father, Zichron Levracha, had the honor many, many moons ago of being invited to a journalists, special foreign journalists and Canadian journalists, correspondents, dinner with the Queen in Ottawa. And he actually had, you know, the honor of meeting her. So it's kind of neat. He did better, by the way, than Mr. Bean did. If any of you have ever seen the famous clip where Mr. Bean is in a hotel and he's waiting to meet the Queen. And by the time he gets to the point where the Queen herself comes out, he accidentally headbutts her, knocks her unconscious by accident. So my father did better, Baruch Hashem, but he pointed out something interesting, which I want to develop tonight. He said that, you know, she didn't eat the dinner. There was no expectation that she would actually join them in the gastronomic part of the festivities, which would make her a really poor Jew, right? So often we only come for the food part and the class, everything else is sort of incidental. Well, the Queen by law, my father told me, will not eat publicly. You may ask why. I think the simplest explanation is for her honor, her dignity. That they're worried that what if someone took a picture of her mid-bite or in a way that was just embarrassing to her and would detract from her status. So therefore, she will only eat in private. She never consumes food or drink publicly, which is kind of interesting, and it's something that I want to develop and talk about. So before we talk more about the Queen and my memories and some things that you may or may not know about her family, her life, her relationship with the Jewish people, with Israel, so let's talk a little bit about the Torah vision of Malchus, royalty, kingship. So we know that when the Jewish people are to enter Eretz Israel, the promised land with Joshua, the Yeshua ben Nun, they're given three specific tasks, right? They have to make war with Amalek and finally destroy the wicked Amalekite nation. They are told to appoint themselves a king. And then, of course, they're supposed to build a Beit HaMikdash, a holy temple, ultimately in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, in the holy city of Jerusalem. So, Som Tasim Alech HaMelech, the idea of appointing yourself a king, is right at the forefront of the Jewish experience in Eretz Israel, in the promised land of Israel. And yet it took a long time before the Jewish people actually had a king. For those of you who are experts in Navi, you'll know that throughout the entirety of the book of Joshua, and then the book of Shoftim of Judges, there is not a king to be found. And the first melech of the Jewish people, the first king, does not appear on the scene until the book of Shmuel, till the first book of Samuel. And we are introduced to the first king of Israel, Shaul HaMelech, King Saul from the tribe of Benjamin, of Binyamin. So you may be wondering, well, I don't understand. I thought the bracha that Yaakov Avinu, that Jacob gave to his children, literally alludes to the scepter, which will never depart from Yehuda, from the tribe of Judah. So we're very familiar with the Judean lineage. So how did this happen? It's a very complex thing. It's a class for another night. Please God, I'll have the opportunity in many moons from now when we'll get back into our learning of Samuel, and we'll address that a little more. But clearly, Judah and Benjamin's kings could have ruled at least concurrently for a long time. But sadly, tragically, Shaul is one who is a tragic, very, very sad personality of Atari. He was a huge tzaddik, a great man of enormous piety, and yet, for all of his tzidkus, his righteousness, he ended in a horrible way, a horrific way. He was killed in battle, and it was an ignoble, very shameful death that he and his son Jonathan, Yonatan, had to be put through, and it's a real tragedy. Because here was a man, Shaul, and his name, by the way, Shaul comes from the word to sort of to borrow, a shoel, someone who borrows from somebody, requests something, and that's what the rabbis allude to, that he was sort of an interim figure as a melech, as a king, but he was ultimately going to be replaced by David HaMelech, King David, and the lineage of David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, etc. Now, backing up for a moment to King Saul, his greatest attribute that made him the quintessential tzaddik, the greatest man in the world at his time, was his anivus, his great humility. His humility was such that it precluded his ability to accept the malchut, to become his royal highness. He didn't want it. In fact, there's a delightful, very profound, almost a little full of humor story of how when Shmuel Samuel presents Shaul, King Saul, to the people, he is already aware that it is Saul. He's already privately anointed him with the special anointing oil, the Shemen. But now he relies on the Urim v'Tumim, God's divine will, to be shown to the people through the Kohen, through the priest who could read the different letters that would illuminate magically from God as a way of communicating on the stones of the breastplate of the Urim v'Tumim that the high priest would wear. And they brought before all the people the different tribes and the different families of the tribe. And ultimately Benjamin is chosen, who was the smallest tribe, who was a shock to the system that it would be Benjamin of all the people, who were almost extinguished because of a horrific incident that happened in the book of Judges. And then finally, when the family of this Shaul ben Kish is selected, who was sort of a very minor family at that time within Benjamin, people were like looking around and like, who is this guy? And then ultimately when Shmuel wants to present, Samuel wants to present Shaul, he's not there. He's not on the dais, he's not on the stage. So it's kind of a little humorous because you can imagine Shmuel and Navi, you know, Samuel saying, and now ladies and gentlemen, Rabosai, let me present to you your new king. And there's no Saul. And where was Saul? Well, they had to inquire through the Urim v'Tumim, through this magical way of speaking to God, that he was actually hiding in the baggage compartment, probably behind like the TSA guys. He somehow was so humble that he didn't want this. And so he sort of hid out off camera. And they had to locate him, bring him out, and then Shmuel Samuel presents Shaul, King Saul. So he was an amazing man. But perhaps the greatest failing that he had was his inability to be a melech, a king. And he allowed the pressure, not peer pressure, but shall we say pressure of the nobility within the Jewish people to coerce him into doing things that were against the Ratzon Hashem, against the will of God, and ultimately led to his destruction. He was replaced, of course, famously with David HaMelech, King David. And King David also was an amazing man. He was not only a tzaddik and the head rabbi of the world, but he also was someone, and my fathers, that's all, love to talk about David HaMelech, they built it that he had like two personas. You know, people would come to King David expecting to see this great mighty warrior who had slain Goliath the giant, and instead they see a man with a Torah wrapped around his arm and his tefillin on the other arm, and he would be immersed in Torah learning as a scholar. And they would wonder out loud, like, wait a minute, where is the Gibor? Where is this great warrior, King David? And then sometimes they would come expecting to see, you know, the Talmud Chacham, and he would be the warrior. So again, the two Torahs that we're told the king had to write, one to be kept in his treasury and the Otsar, and the other to be kept on his person, perhaps they give, in many rabbis' opinions, they give voice to this idea that the king sort of has this public persona, to be the king, because that's what he is. But then privately, he can be off camera, and he can be himself. He's not representative of the nation. So in Jewish law, a king has to be a physical representation and extension of the will of the people. And so the rabbis say that Shaul HaMelech was requested. He didn't emerge, if you will, from the Jewish people as an extension. It was like a request, and he was foisted into that position. And therefore it was doomed to end in a disaster. Masha'in came, but by David HaMelech, he emerged from the will of the Jewish people. There is a famous debate in the Sefer Kedushin, the tractate of Talmud, about whether a person who is owing honor to another person, whether that kavod, that honor, can be put aside. And they start with parents honoring mom and dad. Would a father or mother be able to say to a child, hey, you know, even though that's my makom kavua, that is my space where I eat dinner every Shabbos and every, I'm at the head of the table, you know, Devor Allah, you can sit in my chair, my daughter or my son. Is that okay? So the Gemara is back and forth. And then the Gemara says, well, what about the next level? And it keeps going up levels of honor and respect given. It goes up to a prince, a nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, of the 71 rabbis. And again, there's still a dispute about whether or not a nasi shemochal kvod or kvod mochal. Whether or not the head of the head rabbis, in other words, the biggest of all, would be allowed to sort of forego his kavod, to say, no, you don't have to stand for me. If it's a tircha, you know, you're tired, it's Yom Kippur, and you're hungry, you're famished, you're thirsty, don't stand when I walk by. Would he be allowed, and would he have the Torah license to forego his honor, his kavod? And then they get to the melech. And when they get to the king, the Gemara has consensus. So everyone, all the Tanaim of the Gemara, all the rabbis of the Gemara say, no. Absolutely not. HaMelech Shemochel Kvodo Ein Kvodo Mochel. That if the king tries to say, oh, no, don't stand for me because I'm the king. No, sorry, you must stand. He doesn't have the right to actually forego the honor that is coming to him. So one approach, which I think is germane because it relates to the nature of what we discussed with Saul and with David, with Shaul HaMelech and David HaMelech, and it's going to relate to what we're going to speak about in a few moments with Queen Elizabeth. It's very germane because think about it. Why should it be that a king never has a right to say, don't stand for me, don't show honor and respect that's owing to me? And the simple reason is a king no longer is in charge of his own honor, because that honor belongs to the nation. It is the honor of Am Yisrael, of the entirety of the Jewish people, that's at stake here. You don't have the right, Mr. King, to forgo that honor. You don't have license. You don't have the rishus, the permission of everybody to forgo that honor that is coming to you. Because if you forgo that honor that is coming to you, you are no longer simply a yochid, an individual. You are a representative of the entirety of the people. What gives you the honor? No one. Everyone would have to give you their rishus. And even then it may be questionable. Nobody gave you license to forgo that. So you may not. Now, why is that your man? Because think about it for a moment. The greatness of the House of Windsor and the greatness of what made Queen Elizabeth II such a special person, and I'm sure many of you have seen documentaries and you've read about her, she was committed 100% since age 21 to do what she called duty. And she understood that she is the queen, but she is representative of each and every member of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth. That she doesn't really have herself as a higher calling. She was a young lady on safari in Africa when she heard that George, her father, passed away. And of course, you know the story of George. He's also somewhat of a tragic figure, who his brother, Edward, abdicated for Wallace Simpson and gave up his throne so that Elizabeth's father could become the king. Now, remember, a person is trained all their life. Charles III has been groomed since he was a little baby, basically, to become the king. Whereas Elizabeth's father, it was a very difficult situation for him. Many of you may have seen the movie. It's called The King's Speech. If you haven't seen it, a little bit of bad language, but an amazing scene where he has to literally address the people of the United Kingdom up on the precipice of the war against Hitler and Maximo. It's an amazing movie where he stuttered and had to give this amazing speech. He didn't want this. It was foisted on him. He's almost a little bit like a King Saul. He never asked for this. He was never expected. He was the younger son. There was no expectation he would ever ascend to the monarchy. So again, there's a little bit of analogy there. And then you have a unique situation where it was just Elizabeth and Margaret. There were no boys. So at the point where her dad, Elizabeth's father, becomes king, it's kind of understood what that means for Elizabeth. And she was literally thrown into this when her father died prematurely, was ill, and he died prematurely. And she's on a safari and is notified, "Your Royal Highness, you're it." Now, let me share just as an aside, a very lovely little story. I think people don't understand what it means to be the Queen of England. You hear criticisms, and not of her personally necessarily, but just what it means to be a queen in the United Kingdom's history as a quote-unquote colonizing nation. And again, I'm not going to defend and go into detail here. Clearly, there's black and white without question. We as Jews know that there are mixed results when it comes to the history of the United Kingdom and Israel, the Jewish people, without question. But let me share this very delightful story. You may or may not know that during World War II, Elizabeth drove a truck, supply truck throughout England. That was her cheroot, as they would say in Israel. That was her commitment to give back to England. That was her job during the war. So she was quite a driver. She's young, she was a little bit of a pistol, okay? So the story goes that the king of Saudi Arabia visited her in the 50s when she was now Queen Elizabeth II. She picked him up at the airport in a truck, driving herself, okay? And apparently, she had a heavy foot, and she took him around, and she drove very, very quickly to the point where he got a little nauseous, very quickly, and just sort of gave the tour as the chauffeur to this king. Now remember, in Saudi Arabia, women don't drive. Like, ad hayom hazeh, they don't have the license to drive. They're not allowed to drive. So here's Elizabeth, like, shluching this guy, this real schlub of a human being, the king of Saudi Arabia, by picking him up, knowing that, probably the first time and only time in his life that a woman will ever chauffeur him anywhere, and just to sort of, give him a little one's upmanship and defend our feminine gender. So I thought that speaks volumes about the nature of who she was. But getting back to our insight into Malchut itself, into the Jewish approach to kingship, the fact that a king doesn't have themselves. Every obituary, every time I've seen something in the last few days about Elizabeth, one commonality that I've seen, and maybe you've heard the same type of thing, is that she literally didn't put one step wrong. She's an amazing person. She never made a misstep in her life. Not publicly, ever. She was so careful to defend the honor, the integrity of herself, her office, and more importantly, the people. She never took a political opinion, not once. Never. And that's why people are so scared of Charles, because Charles was a very outspoken advocate of some very controversial opinions, and people are hoping that he'll be able to step back and realize now as the king can't have his own persona out there. A king is an extension of the will of the people. And it's even in a way more profound, the fact that the House of Windsor, the queen only ruled, if you will, literally at the will of the people. She had no official legislative powers, as you know. So it's almost like an ultimate example of somebody who intuitively knew the Torah's idea that a king is this emissary and extension of the will of the people themselves. Now, you hear a lot of people talk about her connection to the Jewish people and to Israel. So I'll say at the outset that she never visited Israel. And from what I have learned over the last few weeks of investigation, because I was interested in this before her demise, people don't really blame her so much as they blame the British Foreign Office, that they kind of told her, it's inappropriate now before there is a lasting peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that you shouldn't go. Now, Other members of her royalty did go. You know that Charles went a few times. And William, her grandson, Prince William, went officially for the first time ever as a representative of the Queen, I think about 4 years ago. And it's also interesting, by the way, to know, you may or may not know this, up until 1982, and Diana said no to this, the practice historically was that every single child of the House of Windsor, every male child, had a bris milah. But not just a circumcision. Charles was mulled, was circumcised by an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. Now that tradition, again, Diana did not want to do this for William. I don't know that what the situation was. It's not a critique of Diana. But that, in 1982, apparently, it stopped with William. But prior to that, an Orthodox rabbi was brought in. And Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zichron Levracha, who was a great, great man, who passed away a couple of years ago, was, of course, the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. And he recalled a very profound moment on a Holocaust memorial occasion where the Queen had a very intimate setting. And literal survivors of Auschwitz-Birkenau came before her and shared their stories with her. And Rabbi Sacks said that she spent hours with these people, many hours beyond the time limit where her handlers were saying, come on, let's go. And she refused. She stood there and she sat there and she listened to each and every word of memory of the Holocaust victims and of their stories. And Rabbi Sacks said he cried. It was such a profound moment that he shared. And current Chief Rabbi Mervis also talks about her. So yes, again, there are shades of gray, perhaps. It would have been wonderful had she visited Eretz Yisrael, Israel, officially or unofficially. But there's no question that she really was an amazing person, an amazing human being, as Rabbi Sacks likes to talk about, who held the kingdom together, her house together. And let me just tell you a story you may or may not know. Her husband, of course, was the late Prince Philip. And Philip's mom was an angel, okay? You can research this after our class. You'll see what I'm telling you is a little bit, a little tip of the iceberg, if you will, of this amazing story. Her name was Princess Alice of Battenberg. And Princess Alice came from, as you can tell, a family from the Germanic area. And in fact, her siblings actually served Hitler in Mach Shemo during the war. And or at least her children, they were literally in the Waffen-SS, one of the children. She herself had married a Greek prince and was exiled. And when Mussolini fell in, I think, 1943, she returned back to Greece. And she had an estate, not a huge garish thing, but something that was located right around the corner from Gestapo headquarters in Greece. Tragically, most of the Greek population who had fled there from Italy and other places was taken away by the Nazis, and only a couple thousand survived the war. But she, this is Alice now, had a family connection to a family named Cohen. And many, many moons ago, there had been a chesed, a kindness that was done for Alice's father. And she knew about it. And Alice's father made her swear that if the time ever came, that she would be there for the Cohen family. And she saved the Cohen family, a couple of their children, and she literally hid them like Anne Frank in her home, where literal Nazis were visiting, and she was playing a little game and keeping them away from the Nazis right around the corner. They survived the Holocaust, the Cohens. And in 1968, she was given into the, I think it's called Yad Vashem's Righteous Gentiles of the World, and she is buried on Har HaZesim. She's buried on the Mount of Olives at her request in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. And this is Prince Philip's mom, who lived in squalor, had a very difficult life where she had schizophrenia and many different maladies. So again, you have this yichus, right, from Alice and from Philip, who was an amazing person with the Jewish people, and Charles is visible. So there's a lot of warmth, there's a lot of love there. So again, I'll end the share now, and I'd like to hear any of your memories or observations. But just to sum up, I really think that we've lost a connection. This was a woman who at age 21 gave a speech, you may have heard the speech, and talked about her life committed to duty. And that was her life, that for 96 years, she gave herself to the people. She didn't really have her own life. If you think about it, that she can never leave her palace. It's a beautiful palace. It's Buckingham Palace. And I know she had estates elsewhere, but she couldn't set foot outside for fear that the paparazzi, who were there all the time, Yom and Valayla, 24/7, would photograph her or see her. So she was a prisoner in the world's most beautiful prison. But it was an amazing sacrifice. The king doesn't have themselves anymore. They give up themselves for the people. So it's an incredible Mesiras Nefesh for the Jewish king to give up, to take that responsibility. That's why when we cry for Shaul, for King Saul and his loss, he didn't want it and ultimately destroyed him. But each and every melech, each and every king ultimately gives themselves to the people that they are emergent from. So again, we hope that her memory, Queen Elizabeth's memories, and all the good things. I think I've now armed everyone with enough information to deflect the naysayers and the people who, unfortunately, I think are very small people who criticize the individual. You can criticize without question the colonization and have questions there. But I think as a human being, she was an enormously larger-than-life human being who was dedicated to do duty for her country, for her people. And I think she was a magnificent human being, and we've lost that connection. So again, I'm going to stop now. Stop my recording, and everyone should please unmute themselves and share any memories or thoughts that they have. Thank you, everyone.